The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Mark Amtower of Amtower & Company, which is entirely responsible for its content.
This is Amtower Off-Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. Every week, author, speaker, consultant Mark Amtower gives you his take on what's going on in the world of government contracting. Amtower Off-Center with your host, Mark Amtower.
Welcome to Amtower Off-Center on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Mark Amtower. My guest today is a longtime friend, editor and host here at Federal News Radio, Tom Temin. Tom and I have known each other since the government computer news days. Tom,
thank you for coming. COBOL was still in fashion back then.
Yeah, well, there's that. we're going to be touching on a lot of things. Not simply in the news, but why the news is important. So I have really no one better to address that with than Mr. Temin. So again, thanks for coming in. We're at the cusp of end of FY. So give me some ideas on the big stories of the last couple of months here. Start with do you want to start overseas or domestic? Let's start overseas. Let's go to that whole ISIS, Ukraine, Gaza morass.
Well, yeah, that's the big story, and you know, we'll talk about what's going on closer to home in the management of the federal government, but you've got this whole ISIS thing, which maybe some people thought that with the withdrawal from Afghanistan and Iraq, things would settle down for the federal government and, you know, for the world. But clearly that's not the case. These are really bad people. People don't need me to say that. And then you've got the whole Gaza, Ukraine. There's a whole crescent of conflict. And so I think over the summer, the world kind of seemed to become a little bit more dangerous and uncertain for a lot of people. So those have been some of the things we've been covering in terms of how they affect what the federal bureaucracy itself has to do and respond.
Well, yeah, and the response part is also, you know, congressional funding, et cetera. So is there any cohesion in Congress on any of these issues?
No. You know, as we speak, they're coming back and settling back in for the sessions. You can hear the wheels touching down on the runways today, bearing all the members of Congress back to D.C., that is, for them, back to their homes. And I say that with some irony there.
Right.
But I think closer to home, it's been an interesting summer. The things I've been watching are the establishment of the digital teams in the government.
Mm-hmm.
I guess maybe in response to what happened earlier in the year with the rollout of healthcare.gov, and now the new open enrollment season is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the protests over that OS3 contract, I think it's where the General Services Administration has maybe taken this whole strategic sourcing to a point where contractors are getting up on their hind legs and saying this is destructive to the market. I think it was Roger Waldron called it suppression of contractors.
Well, when you go back to OS1, we have there were about 550 contractors on the office supply schedule. They pared that down to 20. And really, you know, eliminated thousands of jobs. A lot of those companies are out of business. They were focused on doing business with the government. They were doing so regionally, if not nationally. Even some of the ones that have survived, I have some friends who are in those businesses, and they're about 30% the size of they were prior to OS1.
Well, you probably remember the days when there was the talk, this is probably 20 years ago, but it still goes on, of whether state and local government could use GSA contracts.
Right.
And the issue was kind of torpedoed by groups representing fire truck and fire equipment distributors, which are all local businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And people worried that it would become a national distributorship for fire trucks. And so that's how that got torpedoed in Congress, and they didn't allow that for many years.
Right, but there's only a couple of manufacturers of those things.
Right,
but,
so the distribution and resale of them.
Right.
So how many people make number two pencils? I don't know, copy paper.
But here's part of that issue. Most of the manufacturers have tried to do business with the feds before. They do not like the process. They're not built for the process. So they want to use the resellers and distributors. So, and we've seen companies like Oracle and others vacate the GSA schedule for exactly that reason. It doesn't mean that they're not selling through the schedule. They're just selling through partners, companies like Immix. And
we've seen large retailers come and go also, as well as
CompUSA.
That have trouble with the federal government. So
Best Buy.
So I think, you know, these many, many small businesses, and maybe their distributors, or that is to say the manufacturers also, via their distributors, don't want to see, you know, Staples.gov, basically, which was what OS3 kind of looks like.
Staples? No, OfficeDepot.gov. Staples, a protester.
Yeah, well, the point is it's a, you know, commercial.gov, whatever
right,
it would
become. Yeah, right.
So I think that was kind of a watershed over the summer, is contractors fighting back in a real major way there.
It is, and it's, you know, Roger was right. You know, it is one of those things where the economic impact should be taken into consideration. How much weight should be put there is, you know, another question. There was supposed to be an analysis of that done prior to. Some people argue that that was not done.
Yeah, well, so. I mean, right. I'm sure GSA is buried in analysis. But the question, my other question on that whole thing is, all of that manpower, all that analysis, all of that shenanigans to change around the way they buy, what's really not a very costly commodity in terms of all the things the government buys.
Well, yeah.
We haven't talked about IT procurement, but that's an ongoing, that's an issue for the ages. But, you know, office supplies, I don't know. Is it worth all this effort?
Well, you know, they claim that they're saving this amount of money. There's even some discussion from vendors as to whether or not those numbers are fuzzy numbers or not. So, but again, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it is not a significant savings percentage-wise on that particular schedule. It probably is. But when you pare down from 550 companies to 20 or so, you're going to have 530 companies screaming bloody murder. But, you know, the whole schedule thing, for years and years, they did not seem to care if companies weren't making money. You know, Richard Mackey and I started tracking this several years ago. You know, 30% of the companies on Schedule 70, you know, which had like 6,000 vendors, yes, weren't making any money every year. But, you know, why were they carrying a schedule? They were told by primes, they were told by others, if you don't have a schedule, you're not serious, we're not going to team with you. So they go out and get schedules, and then they don't use them.
Now, yeah, that's GSA. Right. Yeah, the dormant ones, you know. Yeah. And I think the GSA has been trying to do kind of a sweep and clean up there,
yeah,
and also realigning, especially the service contractors. Mm-hmm. As Federal News Radio's Jason Miller has reported, they're trying to realign that into maybe some kind of a new mega type of contract under the schedule system, a new schedule,
right,
so that services have some coherence for people to go buy from the schedules that way.
Well, I think they're doing a pretty good job with OASIS for the service side too. And
well, OASIS just got underway. The operational, mm-hmm, it's now open for business of the unrestricted part.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the small business one opened up a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
But GSA says they've already got orders and they've already got some agency showing interest in OASIS. So, mm-hmm, services buying is a bugaboo for the government.
Right.
Unlike commodity buying.
Yeah.
I mean, the government's good at printers and toners and office supplies, frankly, the way it was. The real issue is services. That's where the big dollars are. So to the extent that GSA can focus there in the schedules, I think they'll get some real payoff.
Well, I know that neither of us is an expert in the next sort of offshoot question, but isn't part of the issue training the contracting and procurement staff more regularly? Because the 1102 community seems to have been underserved training-wise for years now.
Well, that's right, and some bad things happen. I think we have a story today that mentions the fact that the Labor Department is in trouble because its cloud computing contract with a company that's declared bankruptcy for its financial systems. This goes back to 2010. It's going to be costing the Labor Department tens of millions to get their own data and so forth back out of this company, which is kind of ironic because if that contract provision holds, then they will be maybe bailing the company out of bankruptcy because it's going into bankruptcy. So it goes back to what the IG there says is really not great contract writing, not great anticipation of all the contingencies that could happen when you go to the cloud and give away, carry your stuff over the river, put it in the cloud, and next thing you know, how do you get it back if you have to?
Right, but part of being able to bid on these things is having your D&B stuff, your DUNS report in order. So, you got to ask, was that even part of this equation?
Well, at the time I think the contract was awarded, the company was viable and growing and was something of a, well-known outfit. Mm-hmm. And so things do change, though.
They do. If you want more on that story, you can go to federalnewsradio.com and just look up labor or look at the front page. My guest today is Tom Temin, who is the co-host of the Federal Drive every morning here on Federal News Radio. So we're going to take our first break. You're listening to AmTower Off-Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower because nobody else volunteered. My guest today is Tom Temin. Tom, the hot stories for today: Congress returns to Capitol Hill, and you mentioned just briefly to do what? Anything? Is anything going to be accomplished?
Yes, they're back to do a continuing resolution to keep the government open past September 30th.
Okay, so in lieu of another budget, yeah.
Right, yeah. It's not even, it's become cliche to even wonder whether Congress will do its job. The Senate has no bills whatsoever passed. The Senate, under Harry Reid, has simply not passed any budget bills in years. The House passes some of them. So here we go again.
Kind of like shutdown, stones.
Yeah, something like that. Shutdown unlikely. Nobody has the palate for that, so there
it's
will be
an election year.
Yeah,
that would backfire on somebody, and nobody knows who.
And by the way, the Senate will be adjourned on the 23rd of September. They're not even getting a full month of work in. Maybe the House will continue. So it's until the 23rd, a couple of weeks, until there is a continuing resolution to launch. But I think both sides understand that it will be long enough to get them past the election. And then some new Congress, and whatever the composition of that will be is anybody's guess. I guess Democrats are postulating, at least modeling the theory, that it might be Republicans in both the House and Senate. But nobody knows at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Then something else will happen. But in the meantime, if it seems familiar, like an old shoe, like that old sneaker in your closet, that's the CR, and that's mainly what they'll do this session.
Okay. So there was this issue over the Ex-Im Bank, too. I heard you mention that this morning. And the Export-Import Bank has been with us since you and I've been in the market. I don't know how much longer.
It goes back 50 years or so, the Ex-Im
Bank.
Well, then
definitely longer than both of us have been in the market together.
Yeah, and it's one of those types of agencies, one of those issues where the free-floating controversy that is existing in a permanent state in Congress decides to alight like lightning.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Ex-Im Bank finances buyers who wish to buy American goods for export. The crony capitalism or anti-crony capitalism camp says that, why should the federal taxpayer, why should the government be involved in financing people who are going to buy from Boeing and Caterpillar, two of our biggest companies, two of the United States' biggest exporters. The other camp says, why not? Why shouldn't we do this? The government gets the money back. It's loans. It's not grants to those companies.
Right.
And so it's just one of those philosophic points that seems to points of disagreement that in this time it's alighted on the Ex-Im Bank.
Okay. And the other thing that's hitting the fan is taxing sales from the internet, which has been an issue for companies like Amazon from day one.
Well, yeah, the internet, that's the central issue. Nobody thought about it until this FCC came into being, the current mm-hmm. administration, but nobody ever thought about it that much. The internet was the internet.
Well, the states had been talking about it for
a
while.
Yes, and so the question is, can you put a tax on it the way they tax telephone service?
Mm-hmm.
And, in effect, rendering it a regulated utility. And that wasn't much good for the telephone innovation for 60, 80 years until they deregulated some of that. But it's a service, and it's kind of a thing is, you know, if it moves, do you tax it? Or if it moves, do you let it go and grow? And so that's, again, it's a philosophic question playing out on the field of internet governance and internet taxation.
We live in Maryland, you and me, so we know that if it's there, it's taxable. You know, air's next because they already do rain.
Well, it's possible, yeah. I mean, there are states that tend to go that way and states that don't, so it's hard to tell. First of all, Congress has to vote to end the moratorium. They have to vote to extend it because it expires.
Right. Yeah.
And so will that get attached to the continuing resolution, say, by the Republicans who favor extending the moratorium?
Mm-hmm.
Again, anybody's guess.
Right. So once again, coin flip. War planes attacking ISIS. We've been here. But President Obama has a number of things here. He's got criticism for how he initially dealt with ISIS, even though there were continuing drone strikes. Is everybody just vying for airtime to complain?
Well, there's some of that. I think if you want to see what the administration is going to do in the coming days, it's already online at the State Department's website, state.gov. There was an interesting address given by the Secretary of State, John Kerry, at a convocation of he and Secretary Chuck Hagel's, their two counterparts in the UK government,
mm-hmm.
part of that whole trip. And so he says it's going to be something we're going to... He didn't say they're going to come out and destroy ISIL or ISIS, depending on what you want to call it. But he did say that it's something that cannot be left in any fragmentary form, because where you do leave it, you'll have a cancer that could grow to cause further trouble.
Hydra.
Yeah, so that to me is saying we need to destroy it, but he says it won't be our boots on the ground. So I think what you're going to see, Ken, I just read what John Kerry said. I don't have any particular insight into the administration other than that. But you're going to see way increased technical training, even weapons support, plus airstrikes from the United States and its allies. And in some way, I think they're going to really strongly encourage the countries directly involved, like Syria, repugnant as that might be, and Iraq, to join in and go do what needs to be done to ISIS.
Yeah, war creates strange allies sometimes.
Well, you know, who's to like in Syria, really? But, you know, whatever I say, you know.
I'm sure there are innocent people that we could both like.
I think they do have a strategy, and you know, regardless of the comment the president made a couple of weeks ago, you know, there's a lot of politics around that. But I think John Kerry's remarks, right online, it's the main story at state.gov, really tell what the strategy will be. And so that's I think there were you had the Defense Department saying one thing for a while, you had the State Department saying something else in the administration. Maybe there was some disagreements that went public, but I think it seems like they got their ducks in line now.
Yeah. And you know, briefly, the Ebola thing, I mean, that's terrible, but, you know, CDC is certainly responding, National Institutes of Health. They're using some treatments that had not gone through total testing and verification. And apparently, they're working.
Yeah, I mean, here's another example, kind of like ISIS, where look how indispensable to the world the United States is. And so there are a couple of hundred people from CDC that are over there. The military, it came out, is going to, our military, the U.S. military, is going to protect workers of the world coming into West Africa to help out there, not just U.S.
Dangerous
workers.
Dangerous zone,
and there's security issues and so forth, and the military will help build these quarantine facilities there. So the public health practices developed by nations like the United States are just going to be, I guess, temporarily transplanted there. And yeah, the vaccine is showing promise. And then there's this booster shot that they developed that you have to take a couple months later to keep up the work that the vaccine does in the first place.
Right.
And it gets complicated. But the booster shot is a different vial of stuff than the original vaccine that you might have had.
Medicine is not my forte.
No, mine either. But you take the vaccine is working, and in the monkeys, it lasted about 2 months, and then they gave them a booster shot that was a different formula, whatever they put in their germs and goo, and stick it in the monkey's backside with a needle, and then the monkeys were good for 10 months.
Okay.
Well, so hopefully human beings will have the same
That would be good, because we definitely need to contain that bad boy.
That's a good example of where the government working with a contractor can be a successful outcome, because they work with GlaxoSmithKline, to develop this. And so it's really a joint effort between the drug industry and the NIH for a really good outcome and just in time.
Yeah. NIH, Lord knows, they just do thousands of things we never hear about that are just absolutely wonderful for everybody. So
yes, they do.
We'll do a quick applause here for our friends at NIH and CDC and even FDA. I was going to pick up this later on, but let's start it now, and we'll pick it up after the break. But, you know, you've been covering the news for the past 20 years or so. How has reporting on the market changed, morphed, et cetera, in that time? Because, you know, way back we had GCN, we had GovExec, Federal Computer Week, and really, Federal Times, obviously, and the other Uniform Times publications, but that was about it.
Yes, now there are a variety of media, and I'll tell you, in some ways, reporting has gotten better, more immediate, faster with the social media outlays. In many ways, it's gotten much more press release driven, and so the agenda tends to be, in some cases, driven more by the agendas of the companies.
Headlines.
Well, than what they put out and what the government itself puts out.
Yeah.
And than it is by reporters digging and coming up with real hard news stories on their own, partly because of the change in the economics of publishing. And I don't know any of the publications that we knew 20 years ago, even 15 years ago, that have anywhere near the resources staff-wise that they had back then. And so, with fewer people and you have more outlets to put out, because the web is a very voracious, has a very voracious appetite for news. You got to keep it updated a lot. So the volume requirement is up, the number of people down. So I think reporting is maybe a little shallower than it was. But not across the board, but I think in general it is, with some really fantastic exceptions. And the other thing is the rise of these new media companies. We'll talk about that after the break.
Okay.
I think aren't really what you could necessarily call news media in the classic sense.
Okay. Then we'll go ahead and take a break right now. You're listening to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We will be back after these messages. Welcome back to AmTower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. I'm Mark AmTower again. My guest today is Tom Temin. Tom and I are doing a kind of a memory lane thing here on the evolution of news in the government market, but we're going to migrate into why it's important. You were editor at Government Computer News for like 10 years or
15 years.
15,
actually.
Well, long damn time. And it was an extremely robust publication. You had some really good staffers, Job, just a lot of good folks.
Too many to mention, but there were many, many good people over many years.
Exactly.
And a lot of them still in the market.
And I'm connected to a lot of them on LinkedIn, because I stay in touch because they're still, writing somewhere.
Sure they are.
And I like their stuff. But, the web introduced a lot of different things, not the least of which is, and a lot of people don't remember this, Federal News Radio was the first web-based radio show. It was online before it was on air.
Yeah, that's right, and that's before I got here, but I guess 12 years ago or so, it did start out as a new journalistically driven medium. And it started out modestly. I had a website, basically the broadcast was a webcast.
Yeah.
And then soon we were at 1,000 watts on 1050. And then shortly after I got here, it became 3,000 watts, and we had a big poster, triple the power. And then because of changes outside of the station, we were able to move into the big legacy AM
stick. 1500 AM.
1500 AM goes back to 1920 or so in Washington. And it's 50,000 watts, and so that's where we are now.
Yeah.
And also the programming, though, has really grown and matured to go with that wattage.
Well, it's funny because Steve Ressler's thing, GovLoop, started off by for and about feds. That's how Federal News Radio really started. It wasn't by feds, but it was all for feds. Online, and then for the first 3 or 4 years on air. My show was actually the first one to deal with the contracting side of the market. That's why they asked me to come over and start AmTower Off Center. You came on, literally within months after that, and the coverage has broadened continually ever since.
Yeah, well, I think we are journalistically driven. We don't have an agenda. We understand federal employees. We understand contractors. We are not the champions of them. We're not cheerleaders for either side.
No.
But we cover what they do.
Right.
And it's a place where, frankly, if there's something positive happens in the federal government, for us, that's news. So maybe in that sense. But we didn't start as a club for feds or as a website or a social media site for federal employees. And so we don't champion them. We cover them.
Right.
And we try to give them a good dose of service journalism to help them improve how they operate with expert opinion and good case histories and so forth. But it's still highly journalistically driven.
Right.
And, I think we do a good job. We've got the day of federal employees or a contractor employees manager's day bookended with federal drive in the morning and Francis Rose on In-Depth taking them out from, in the afternoon from 4 to 7. So, we've got them covered one way or the other.
Yeah. And Jarb.
Plus all day online.
Yeah, right. So I send out a weekly newsletter to all of the group members that I have on the groups that I run on LinkedIn. And part of that is, my three top stories of the week. The first place I go for my top stories of the week is Federal News Radio, because they're going to have something on virtually everything that impacts the market. So
yeah, we cover the information technology, we cover acquisition and procurement, plus all the pay and benefit issues, plus management issues, plus just news that develops, whatever it might be.
And here's why I wanted to talk about that. You and I have known for years that being on top of all of these things is a contractor's number one job. You have to know the nuances of the market to understand what's impacting the agency. Oftentimes, understanding the news will enhance when you're reading the OMB 300s or 53s, because something in the news will trigger, this has just moved up or down the priority list, so it's going to impact how my sales and business development people are migrating. But from your perspective, what's going on in the news that people really have to know, and why?
Well, I think they have to know what the policy developments are. I mean, if you're a federal contractor, you are really dealing at any given time with three fiscal years. This is the one you're in, and there's the one that's under development, and then there's the one that's being planned after that, because they all overlap because of the 18-month development and execution cycle of the federal fiscal year. And so you have to be ready for the, opportunistic opportunities that might come up during the current fiscal year. But you really have to be always doing the spade work for the next, for example, we're right in the end of year fiscal now for 2014. You've got a couple of weeks left. And people use this quarter to try to make their numbers. But you're not going to launch any strategic major initiatives at this point unless it's been in the works for a long, long time.
Right.
And then there's 2015, which is pretty much done as far as agency planning is concerned. And so you need to be aligned with what it is you see for 2015. But really now agencies are deep in the preparation of 2016 budgets. So you got 3 years to deal with. So you have to know, you have to know what it is they want strategically, as you said, through the Exhibit 53s and so on, that they submit for their budget documents. But then you also have to know what the policy changes are happening now that could affect what they put in those exhibits and in those plans on down the line.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you need to know the immediate news. You have to know how apportionment works. You have to know how procurement cycles work. And you have to know how budget cycles work. And you have to be able to filter out the wheat from the chaff to know what the real opportunities are. It's tough work. That's why they have a separate business development staff, separate marketing people, and they also have people, they learn from contracts they have what's going on and what the thinking is. But yeah, you have to get into the federal customer's head just the same, legalistic and controlled as it might be. It's still a very human environment.
Yeah, in one of my favorite groups on LinkedIn, Carl Dixon's business development proposal writing, it's got like 10 words in the title, but Carl is a BD guru, right? So he does a lot of great work in the proposal arena. There's been a discussion going on in there now for about 3.5 months, and it started with the question, are services like Dell Tech worth it? Well, you know, that's a pretty silly question, because can you do the research yourself?
Yeah, look, it's worth it if at the end of the year you find out about insight or opportunities that you didn't know about. So one contract can pay for all of that, whether it's Bloomberg or Dell Tech, or they do quality work, yep. Those groups, from what I've seen.
Yeah.
And so I can't imagine a contractor of any size not having at least one of them piped in, because why would you avoid a source of information? And sometimes you got to pay for it.
Yeah, and you know, lower priced services. I'm not saying that they're lesser quality, because I'm you know, EasyGovOps, FedMine, you know, Dell Tech bought its last major competitor, Centurion. They were probably growing enough that Dell Tech just said, you know, we don't need the headache. I'm just going to buy them. Nice to have a wallet like that. But you know, for the smaller companies, there is that perpetual complaint. I can do this myself. Well, show me how you do it, and I'll tell you whether or not it's valid. If you're counting on FBO to track upcoming stuff, you're behind the curve.
Well, that's right. Business development in the absence of business intelligence may not be very effective. So I think, you know, business development is a technique unto itself, but business intelligence is an allied but wholly different type of activity. And so if you can shortcut that with a paid service, I think that's an efficient way to go.
Then we're going to take our last break and come back and discuss a few other things that are coming down the pike. You're listening to Amtower Off Center. My guest today is Tom Temin. You can find Tom right here at federalnewsradio.com. Back after these. Welcome back to Amtower Off Center on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest today is Tom Temin, host of the Morning Drive here at Federal News Radio. We have this migration of people leaving, and it seemed like there was a lot of them recently. You guys have been reporting on this, Francis, you know, you, Jared, etc. does it happen more at the end of an administration? Is question number one.
Well, it happens at the beginning of a first term or the end of a first term. But I think there's a point at which people in the second term say, if you stay from the first term to past a certain point, you're expected to stay over for the reelection. Presumably that happens, and mostly it does. And then if you come on at some point in the beginning of the second, I think you're asked. Again, nobody's under legal stricture, but you're asked kind of morally to stay to the end. So a lot of the people that have, like Dave McClure, left GSA, you know, a few weeks ago, a couple of months ago, and now took a job in the private sector at a security company. You know, he went over the reelection and over the establishment of the second term, and that's kind of when people decide, I've done the work and I'm free to go, type of thing. So it's an eternal turnover. And it's always thus.
Yeah. Simon Seichman stayed for 7 years, something like that?
Yeah, some of them do. I mean, some of them like it. Some of them do good work. Someone was one of those. You know, Bob Brees just left. Mm-hmm. And some people move within. Not so much at the political level, like Maria Rote, who came from the military, ran FedRAMP at GSA for a long time. Now she's moved on, I believe, to Transportation Department as a CTO, Chief Technology Officer. So this kind of ferment, I think, is just the way it is.
Okay. Now, this is more of a causey question, but Mike's not here. But, you know, I was one of the early ones, and this is like 7-8 years ago, saying, you know, the senior executive service is at retirement age. The tsunami's about to happen. Well, I was wrong, because it didn't happen when I said it was, because the economy went just straight south and nobody vacated the premises. I've been wrong before, but I think it was just twice.
We'll look it up. Amtower was wrong. Yeah. We'll Google it.
Well, there may be some debate there. but, you know, in point of fact, the SES community is starting to migrate. Is the tsunami, do you think, finally here?
Well, no, I don't think it ever really comes. I think that there's a, I've heard about it for all these many years as you have, and you never really see a mass sudden migration, and so these things come in waves, but you can't take the anecdote of three or four people at once as somehow indicating the giant trend, and so I think the government, you know, they used to say Cadillac will, this was when there was a big depression in the car industry a long time ago. They said Cadillac is doomed because their average owner is 58 years old. Well, you know, my thought was, well, don't new people get to be 58 every year? And, you know, here we are 25 years and Cadillac is still going strong.
Yeah, it's one of the people. Brands that GM kept. Yep.
Yeah, what their average owner age now is, I have no idea. But there are lots of young feds coming in. People come in at different points in their career. So I don't really, I think that's one of those issues that gets talked about but never really happens.
Now, you said something there that I can't take issue with, but I'll question. New feds coming in, is there a problem filling all the federal jobs that are out there right now? Yeah, I hear different things that I honestly do not know.
I think it varies by agency. I know a couple of young graduates personally, friends of my kids, who have gotten really good jobs in the scientific agencies. Like NIH is a great place because you always need fresh scientific knowledge coming in, so they're hiring. You know, whether someone wants to be a program analyst at transportation or labor department, I don't know. I think if their jobs are hard to fill, it's because the government makes them hard to fill by the crazy hiring process that it has. I mean, you know, the people in Silicon Valley loves the government. The government seems to love Silicon Valley, whatever that's in vogue right now. Silicon Valley, it doesn't take 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months to get a job offer.
No, but it takes a very different kind of interview process there, and they ask some very off-the-wall questions, but the process
itself is
expedited.
Yep.
So they ask the off-the-wall questions because they want to make sure you're thinking out of the box and you have an answer that, you know, like why why aren't there square manhole covers is one of the questions. And the answer is because square manhole covers can actually fit through the hole.
They can fall in, right?
Yeah.
At an angle.
And had I not read that answer, I may not have known it.
Yeah, well, it's a matter of geometry.
Yes.
But, you know, there's all this talk about innovation in government. And, you know, there's another school of thought emerging that maybe you don't want too much innovation in government. Government's supposed to be steady, reliable, rock solid. And as long as people get the benefits that they're supposed to get or the services they're supposed to get or government delivers what it's supposed to do in a reliable and efficient way, that would be the innovation.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes they this idea of innovation in government, maybe it's better suited to the private sector and you want government to be a little stodgy.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that are happy in a stodgy environment, do well there. And so, you know, I guess I have faith that the government can continue to be fine, whether it, even if it doesn't become Silicon Valley.
Well, you know, we were talking about this between takes here, and one of the first major Silicon Valley figures to come out here was Amit Yoran, and that was right after 9/11, and he was like the
cybersecurity guy.
Yeah, yeah, but he was cyber czar, whatever, at DHS. He did not stay long, and my theory has always been that the glacial nature of change in government would drive Silicon Valley people absolutely bonkers. So now we have Megan Smith, who's come from Google to be Mr. Obama's, President Obama's new CTO government-wide. You and I have seen the procurement side for years and years, and there's a reason that I coined the phrase, I want to be third. Nobody in government wants to be on the bleeding edge of technology in case it doesn't work, because it's their butt on the line.
So much at stake.
Yeah. So Ms. Smith and whoever, you know, from the Twitterverse coming in, are they going to get frustrated?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, I think these are highly intelligent individuals. They're experienced individuals. I think they know what they're getting into.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they have to also set their priorities. I mean, if you come into government and you want to do good, and many people, that's their motivation for coming into government. They do want to do well. They don't want to do good by the public, and that's noble. I mean, public service is a noble calling. But from a practical sense, you've got to pick what it is you want to do, and you need to pick two or three priorities. She's only got
2 years.
2 years.
Yep.
So pick two or three things that where she can have an impact. Do those well, and don't try to boil the ocean.
There you go. Final thoughts here.
Well, final thoughts are that the Republic will survive. It's going to be a rough summer, you know, or rest of summer, the few days left of summer and the fall with Congress, and there will be continuing resolution to contractors. Now's the time to understand the source of the money for what will be bought under that CR, because there's surprising sources that the government is able to spend, even though it seems like they may not be able to under a CR. So do the deep homework, understand apportionment and so forth. Steve Charles at the Immix Group is a real good one for that,
yep,
in terms of knowing the deep processes. And he's someone I've learned a lot from. So
you and me both.
Yeah, so I think it's going to be a typical fall. It should be one that we've seen before. And, you know, go get them.
There you go. Tom, thanks so much. This is not my day job. LinkedIn now has over 320 million members, a third of those in the U.S., 3 million within 50 miles of the zip code of this radio station. And there's 1.4, my latest post on LinkedIn is 1.4 million feds, DOD, uniformed services, and civilian on LinkedIn. Your LinkedIn profile is the cornerstone of your business future. So let me ask you this. What's in your LinkedIn profile? If you don't like the answer, call me. Shoot me an email, markhamtower@gmail.com. And thank you very much for listening to Amtower Off Center.
You've been listening to Amtower Off Center, sponsored by General Dynamics Information Technology. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Amtower Off Center, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.